Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, listener mail. This is Robert Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And it's Monday. This is the day of the week that we read back messages you've sent into the show. Rob, if you don't mind, today I think I'm going to get started with this message we got from Adam.
Let's do it.
Okay, this is replying to previous listener mail about the 7-day week episodes, and a note here. Adam, who is a rabbi, wrote in with a shorter message about the history of the Sabbath observance and public Torah readings in the ancient Near East, and he mentioned that his rabbinical thesis was actually on the subject of how space colonization might affect the observance of the Sabbath week, and obviously, that's right up our alley. We were very interested in that subject, so he wrote in again to share more. So Adam says, "Hey Joe and Rob, thank you for the fantastic show. I've been listening for years now. I'm thrilled to hear you're interested in the topic of my rabbinical thesis. It's called Eyes on the Horizon, Theological and Halakhic Challenges to the First Jewish Settlers on the Moon, Mars, and Beyond. I have always been very scientifically minded, even as a rabbi. In rabbinical school, we needed to write a thesis before ordination. One day, while sitting in class, I had an epiphany. What would a Jewish prayer book look like for future exo-Jews living on Mars? I reached out to friends and colleagues and posed the question. I asked what blessings they may recite, for instance. In Judaism, a blessing is a formulaic sentence that makes a moment or ritual holy. Before eating an apple, for example, I may say, 'Blessed are you, eternal our God, ruler of the universe, creator of the fruit of the tree.' So I asked what blessings someone on Mars may recite. Is there a blessing for landing on a new celestial body, etc.? Before I found a thesis referee, I had been turned down by several professors. The first one said, quote, 'Judaism doesn't exist off-planet. That's not a thesis. Judaism is the relationship between God, Israel, and the Earth.' I eventually found someone who agreed to advise me. My thesis referee, being an expert in Jewish halakha, which is Jewish law put forth by the rabbis throughout the centuries, recommended bringing in that aspect. So half of my thesis became a theological exploration of whether Judaism can exist off-planet and what theological complications might arise by trying to live Jewishly off-planet. My second half focused on how one could follow Jewish law, particularly concerning the issue of Jewish time off-planet at all. One main thought experiment, for example, is the halakhic issue of the, quote, lost traveler. It is as follows. Suppose you are a religious Jew who is traveling through the wilderness. You realize that you have lost track of the day, so you don't know when Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, will begin. Jewish law stipulates you must count 6 24-hour periods from the moment you lost track. The 7th 24-hour period is to be your Shabbat. You must say the proper blessings one says on Shabbat. That way, you fulfill the commandment of keeping the Shabbat. However, you still cannot violate the actual Shabbat, even if you don't know which day it will actually be, so you must remain in a state of pseudo-Shabbat at all times until you have once again found civilization. That means you cannot do anything that counts as something forbidden on Shabbat. You may only do that which keeps you alive or helps you travel toward civilization once again. Thus, to apply to the context of Jews living off-planet, if one has difficulty determining what day of the week it is, whether that means you must follow the time on Earth or the time of a Martian society, must that religious Jew remain in a state of pseudo-Shabbat on Mars? Finally, Adam attaches a link to a PDF of his thesis so that we can take a look. Maybe we will in the future. And then says, all the best, Adam. But thanks so much, Adam. Fascinating. I love it.
Yeah, this is exactly what we were hoping we would hear back from people on. Yeah, this is fascinating.
I mean, I think questions like this are actually really interesting from the religious point of view, even if you're not actually going to be applying them to, say, living off planet. I mean, we're probably not going to be living off planet in our lifetimes, but it's very interesting from a religious point of view because it forces you to ask questions about, like, what is really the spirit of the law or of this requirement within my religion? So if, like, normally you can just follow the law as written, but if the circumstances of your environment change such that it's not really possible to follow the law as written, say if you're on a different planet and the law depends on time periods that are contingent on the length of the day on Earth or something like that, then it forces you to ask, okay, well then what is the law really about? What is the law trying to get me to do? And how could I most closely replicate that in a scenario where the law as strictly written can't apply?
Yeah. Yeah. And also just the sort of general theme of what happens when you have a given religion and new cosmological information presents itself. This is always fun to discuss. You know, in many cases, nothing changes, and maybe nothing has to change because certainly, like you said, we don't have people living in space. But then you have some curious examples, like some details from Hindu mythology, where you had mythological entities based upon observable cosmological properties, and then as knowledge of those things changed, so too then did the structure of the mythological entities change.
What do you mean by that? Like certain observations of heavenly, like the moon and the sun and things?
I think the example I'm drawing on, we discussed in our eclipse episode years back, where you had different interpretations of what was happening with, I can't recall offhand if it was solar or lunar or both, but as a Hindu understanding of what what the observable phenomena happened to be changed, then instead of like separating that from the mythological model, they updated the mythological model, which I always found very interesting. Anyway, fun episodes, as I recall. So go back and listen to those if anyone is interested.
Yeah. I think those may have been my first ever episodes on the show.
Oh, okay. A while back then.
Yeah.
All right, this next one comes to us from Jolt. Hi, Robert and Joe. Just writing to chime in on the topic of connections between the names of days and markets, as brought up in the recent listener mail episode. In my native tongue, Hungarian, the word used for Sunday literally means market day. The pronunciation itself changed from the original word for market. Vassar, to now being Vassar Nap, market day, but the meaning is still there. Sunday, as the designated day for markets, goes back at least to the first king of Hungary and to the introduction of Christianity in the 11th century, but is still very much a cultural reality today, with markets being held almost exclusively on Sundays, especially in the form of various pop-up markets in the countryside and in villages. Thank you for the great show, Jolt.
I feel like we're seeing major themes emerge. There are like three main branches of day naming conventions. One is naming them with numbers, so they go first day, second day, third day. The other is naming them in relationship to a market day, so you have a day that's called market day, and then others are named like, I don't know, first from market, second from market, something like that. And then the third is naming them after celestial bodies, so you've got Sunday, Moon Day, and so forth. And according to that last convention, we could actually look at this next message from Jacinth, who says, listen to your episodes on the 7-day week. Great content. My mother tongue is Tamil, which is the language of the state of Tamil Nadu in India. Here are the days of the week are the names of celestial bodies. I'm going to try these. I apologize in advance for mispronunciation, but Sunday is Nyayiru, meaning the sun. Monday is Thingal, meaning the moon. Tuesday is Shivai, meaning Mars. Wednesday is Pudan, meaning Mercury. Thursday is Vyajan, meaning Jupiter. Friday is Veli, meaning Venus. And Saturday is Sani, meaning Saturn. And then Jacinth says, I'm an English literature graduate and generally love different language works. You learn a lot of fascinating things from various language literatures. Couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. All right, let's move on to some Weird House Cinema listener mail. This first one comes to us from Charlie. And Charlie writes in and says, hello, science boys, B-O-I-S. I have a simple question, semi-related to your Beastmaster 2 Weird House episode. Is Encino Man's Brendan Fraser a meat beast? If the requirements are learns about rock music and slushy machines and teaching a young me my first Spanish phrase. Thanks, Charlie.
Excellent choice. You know, I was thinking of Encino Man while we were doing the Beastmaster 2 episode.
I don't think I ever actually watched Encino Man. I think I was always a little turned off by the trailers for that one.
I don't think I saw it either. I just know of it.
Does he escape from a biodome? Like, I didn't see Biodome either.
No.
So I kind of have combined these into one film where Encino Man escapes a biodome with Pauly Shore.
Encino Man is the unfrozen caveman lawyer skit from SNL, but it's a whole movie of it. I guess he's not a lawyer. He becomes like a rock and roll guy.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he's just a caveman who they unfreeze him, and here he is.
All right. He's learning.
He's putting on high top sneakers.
I mean, there are other caveman in the modern day films. I wonder how robust that subgenre truly is, and how many of those we could classify as meat beast pictures.
I recall Brendan Fraser being pretty buff in the in the poster art for Encino Man. So I think he comes pretty close. I don't know if he's full on barbarian, but he's something. He's something in the zone. One last note here is I'm wondering why Charlie is calling us science boys, because I'm reading B-O-I-S as, isn't that the French word meaning wood, bois, science wood? I don't know.
Yeah, Webster's is saying it's wood. Webster's is not necessarily hip to slang.
Okay, well, I like that. We are now the science wood. Build a treehouse out of us.
All right, what else do we have? This can't be the only listener mail we received about Beastmaster 2.
Oh, no, it was not. Let's see. Brian wrote in to say, hi, Rob and Joe. I was listening to your Weird House Cinema episode on Beastmaster 2 this morning during my daily walk, and as I always do when you're covering a movie I haven't seen, I began looking for stills from the movie so I could have more context. I'd seen the original Beastmaster many times as a child, and the sight of the leather-clad, glowing-eyed meat man absolutely terrified me. I was mainly interested in seeing if this figure that haunted my nightmares returned in the sequel. He apparently does not. So, Rob, you are the person who knows about Beastmaster 1. Do you know who Brian is talking about? There's another meat man, but this one is scary?
Yeah, I don't recall the name of this, if this thing even had a name, but there's a wonderful sequence in the film where we're in the like the dungeons of the evil Max, played by Rip Torn, and there's, you know, all sorts of like evil cult shenanigans going on down there, hands reaching out of cages. It's wonderfully scary stuff, and there is this kind of like rampaging like muscle man with like an iron mask, and I think they've like jacked him up with some sort of nefarious magical chemicals. So yeah, it's real great nightmare stuff. I mean, we have to remember with Beastmaster too, if you haven't seen it, you know, this is the same mind that brought us Phantasm. So there's plenty of,
you mean
like
Beastmaster
wild
one.
Yes, I'm sorry, Beastmaster 1. Beastmaster 2 had nothing to do with, but yeah, Beastmaster 1, this is Don Coscarelli. So yeah, there's a lot of like really cool, very creative ideas in there. It's not just your blueprint barbarian film.
Yeah.
You've got these beefy men with the iron masks. They're the crazy cool bird creatures, the winged creatures that externally digest their prey. Oh, there's a bunch of other stuff as well. You have some hags, some wonderful hag action going on.
Love a hag. Mm-hmm. Does it have a ball like in Phantasm?
There's no ball, but there's a magic ring.
Okay, that's close. It's round.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, so Brian's message is not over. Brian says, while searching for pictures from the movie, I came across its poster. I thought I might have mistakenly searched for Back to the Future 2 instead of Beastmaster 2 because the posters are shockingly similar. For your consideration, and then Brian attaches little screen captures of both posters, and woo, I got that is that that is worthy of a lawsuit right there. I mean, that is really, really close. Everybody's, it's framed the same way. It's got a similar color scheme. It's got the car coming out of the portal in the same orientation and the characters posed the same way. Either this is just they're both taking part of a standard template for movie posters of the time, or Beastmaster 2 is doing a bit of a copycat job.
Yeah, I mean, it could be the same artist as well. I wouldn't discount that. I didn't have time to research these and try and figure out who might have created them. But that's always a possibility. Maybe this is just how the particular artist tended to style things.
Could be. And, you know, and of course, movie posters they're not always created ex nihilo. So maybe there's just sort of a template, you know, there's a format of how you were doing movie posters at the time, and a lot of them looked like this. Maybe that's the case.
There are some other posters. I was looking around for Beastmaster 2. There's one that has a huge Wings Hauser on there with his little Phantom of the Opera faceplate. That one looks pretty good.
Well, anyway, Brian goes on and says, maybe I'm imagining things because I recently watched the Back to the Future trilogy, but I have a strong mental image of a Simpsons-esque ponytailed Hollywood executive saying time travel, cars, lightning, high tops, put them on the box, in the hopes that Beastmaster 2 would cause a double take at the local Blockbuster. Someone out there knows the truth. Love the podcast and love the Weird House episodes. Please keep doing them, Brian. Now, one last thing I have to say about this Beastmaster 2 poster is that they do not include Wings Hauser or Sarah Douglas on the poster. You're only seeing the heroes, and I think that's a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, you have some fun villains in that movie, so you might as well get them on the poster. But I don't know, this idea of like, yeah, you just need to turn heads at the video store. I mean, that was a huge deal. In fact, oh man, I was just thinking about this the other day. I was in Videodrome, our local and our city's only video store, video rental store, and I noticed they had like a new, I think a Blu-ray edition of the 1989 film The Dead Pit, which I don't know if you're familiar with this one, Joe. I've not actually seen it. It was directed by Brett Leonard and stars nobody in particular. But the crazy thing about it is the classic VHS and now Blu-ray DVD art for this movie was this kind of Frankenstein looking dude kind of emerging from a looks like a hole with hands reaching out of it, and there's like some light behind him. And on the old VHS box, I guess it was like they must have sent this special, you know, the eyes lit up. It had a little bitty like Halloween costume LED, I guess, or the predecessor to LED little eyes inside, and it would light up and possibly make noises. I don't remember particularly, but the eyes definitely lit up, as so that when you were strolling through the horror section or the new arrival section, it's like it's just shrieking for your attention.
I wonder if that kind of marketing gambit paid off. Like, you invest more money into complicated packaging, do more people rent it?
I don't know. Maybe they're like, maybe they just thought, well, heck, we picked this movie up for virtually nothing. Nobody wants to see this thing. What if we just throw a little more cash at the VHS box art? Because I think it was also, it had kind of like a 3D cover as well. It would just get people excited about it. They'll just be sold on it and they'll just have to rent it. And I want to say there was at least one other film from the time period that did something like this with light up eyes. Yeah, you know, of course you don't see that anymore. And I was disappointed a little bit when I saw it there on the shelf at Videodrome and it didn't have light up eyes. And I think I even commented to the guy working there. I was like, oh man, it doesn't have light up eyes. Don't you remember the light up eyes? And he said, no.
It's funny how often we come back to talking about VHS boxes that we remember from walking through the video store as a kid. I feel like this is a recurring theme. Like, didn't we get into one time the Jason Goes to Hell video box cover?
I think so. What was special about that one?
Well, it's just really eye-catching. It's like a metal-looking Jason mask that's got this demon snake coming out of one of its holes. It's just gross-looking and fitting for that movie.
Ah. Well, you know, I just looked up a Bloody Disgusting article, The Coolest and Most Unique Horror VHS Boxes. It reminded me of Dead Pit. It also reminds me that, the VHS box for Metamorphosis, which I believe was George Eastman's, this is the film he directed and wrote. I haven't seen this one either, but it had some sort of light up eye scenario. And then this rings a bell as well. Do you remember a Fright Night Part 2 VHS box that was shaped like a casket?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm looking it up. Well, you may have implanted a false memory, because when you said that, I was like, oh, yeah, that does seem familiar. I just looked up pictures of it, and I was like, yeah, actually, I don't think I've ever seen this. So your enthusiasm is infectious. It made me remember things I've never seen.
Wow, I'm not even seeing this casket thing pop up on eBay, but I was just curious. I was like, how much are these things going for? But maybe they're just too rare.
Literally priceless.
Mm-hmm. All right, more Beastmaster. This one comes to us from Brad. Hello, gentlemen. I apologize if I am the 1,000th person to write in about this, but just in case I'm not, I had a thought as to why Jackie may have reacted the way she did to Dar's ferrets.
Now, remember, this is a thing from the movie where the character played by Carrie Wuerer, she sees Mark Singer's ferrets and she reacts as if they're some kind of like a fantasy creature, like an animal unknown in the real world, like a unicorn or something, but they're just ferrets. Ferrets are earth animals.
Brad continues, see, ferrets are actually not native to California and also have been deemed too invasive of a species to allow them as pets. So ferrets are actually illegal in California. I have heard that special arrangements can be made to get one that is declawed to prevent predation on other critters and de-scented, meaning they remove the scent glands. I believe to make finding mates and therefore breeding more difficult if they were to get out in the wild, but I'm not sure if these rumors are true. Coincidentally, Dar actually commits a federal crime by giving them to Jackie. That one pair could have decimated California wildlife had they been a breeding pair. LOL, Brad.
Very good note, Brad. Thank you. And yeah, this does bring to mind the controversy about ferrets in The Big Lebowski, you know, where Walter clarifies that you're not allowed to have an animal like that in California.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Wouldn't it be funny if that's where the interrogation, when Mark Singer gets arrested by the police, if that's where the interrogation went? It's like, I need to know about these ferrets. How'd you get them into the state?
And that becomes the central plot, yeah.
Okay, one last message. This comes from Alan, and it is about the Green Bay's Vampire and the song about green stamps. Alan says, greetings from England, and thanks for the fascinating show. I am having trouble believing that trading stamps are so forgotten that adult people don't even know what they were. Here, green shield stamps were given out by supermarkets, so many stamps for each pound spent. And I remember sticking them into books for my parents, then full books could be taken into the green shield shop and spent like money on goods out of their catalog. You can imagine the piles of books necessary as the big co-op stamps fill a whole page and is worth 1.33 pence. The U.S. blue chip stamp is worth one, quote, mil, which I take to be a tenth of a cent. I believe when the stamps went obsolete, the stores continued just selling for cash and still exist under the name Argos. All the best, Alan. Or maybe that's Argo, A-R-G-O-S. And then Alan attaches pictures of the green shield stamps. It's funny, after I saw these, I had a memory of within the past year, some of my in-laws going through a relative's possessions and finding a bunch of these in a box, and I didn't know what they were.
All right. I was doing a little searching in the background, and I just want to let everybody know that I did find on eBay an old entry, well, not that old, from January, the ultra-rare Fright Night Part 2 VHS in the coffin presentation pack. It went for $380.
Whoa.
Yeah, so that's a serious collector's item there.
Maybe literally worth its weight in gold.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, we're going to go ahead and call it there, but we'd love to hear from everyone. If you have responses to any of these listener mails, write in, let us know. Let's keep the conversation rolling. If you have anything you want to add regarding previous episodes of the show, Stuff to Blow Your Mind or Weird House, thoughts about potential future episodes, write in and let us know. If you have memories of particular weird VHS tapes from VHS rental stores of old, yes, definitely write in and tell us all about that. Send us pictures if you have them. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Listener Mail, they come out on Mondays. We do Artifact on Wednesday, that's short form. Core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind Tuesdays and Thursdays. And on Fridays, we do Weird House Cinema. That's our time to set aside most serious matters and just discuss a weird film.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.